Andrew Jackson, Indian fighter, victor of the Battle of New Orleans, 7th President of the United States, first Westerner in the White House, author of the policies that led to the Trail of Tears, and you might think an unlikely subject for a Broadway musical until you hear the phrase, "He puts the man in Manifest Destiny."
Why wouldn't you ever go out with me in school? You always went out with those guys who thought they were so cool. And I was just nobody to you, nobody to you, nobody to you. But it's the early 19th century, and we're gonna take this country back for people like us who don't just think about things, people who make things happen. Sometimes with guns, sometimes with speeches too, and also other things.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Populism, yeah, yeah. Populism, yeah.
That tune opens a show called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson that opened originally at the Public Theater in New York City. He's now making the transition to Broadway. The man responsible for that music joins us in just a moment. If you have questions about how a musical development develops, grows, and evolves, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website, too. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Michael Friedman wrote the music and lyrics to Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. He and writer-director Alex Timbers created the show. Michael Friedman joins us here at the NPR Bureau. First of all, congratulations on your transition to Broadway.
Thank you so much.
And you are in previews. What does that mean? You're rehearsing all day and performing at night?
They are rehearsing as we speak, putting in new light cues, changing things, fixing things for the audience tonight. And we continue for a couple more weeks in previews till we open.
And this must be, well, you're moving from one theater to another. You're moving from one audience to another as well.
Yeah, it's from, as it were, a downtown audience at the Public Theater to what we call an uptown audience on Broadway, though I think it's just exciting for Alex and me that we get an opportunity to reach a bigger and broader audience, so it's exciting.
I saw the show on Tuesday night. I guess that was your second preview or something like that?
That was our second preview.
And the number of young people in that audience, remarkable for a Broadway crowd.
It's exciting. We had a really great experience at the Public. Even for down there, the audience was surprisingly young and varied, and I think we're looking towards that uptown as well, so that's an exciting thing for us.
And tell us a little bit about the genesis of this show. Why did you decide to do The Trail of Tears as a musical comedy?
Well, Alex and I were set up on what we like to call a professional blind date by a mutual friend who suggested we should really work together. And we got together for coffee. And literally after about an hour, we sort of turned to each other and said, what about an emo rock musical about Andrew Jackson? And from there, who knew that that idea would blossom into a Broadway show? So the idea, Alex and I had both been interested in historical figures and in ways of looking through a contemporary lens at history, and I think we found that Andrew Jackson, and this was 5 years ago, really spoke to the moment that we were living in and planted the seeds of so much of what we see now, and I think in recent politics we've seen even more of that. So,
take this country back, that phrase in that song suddenly resonating again
exactly.
Throughout America. But 5 years,
yeah.
5 years between an idea and you finally make it to Broadway.
Yeah, and that's quicker than some shows, so we feel very lucky. But it's a long development process for any musical. You write it and then you workshop it and then you premiere it and then you rewrite it and then you fix it and finally, here we are, and we're still fixing it.
And you're still fixing it.
Exactly.
The show uses, as you could hear, obviously anachronism. Mm-hmm. There's a teacher who appears in a wheelchair and lectures us from time to time until she's eliminated. but it also uses a lot of sarcasm and a lot of jokes, including musical jokes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something Alex and I found, that using comedy and different kinds of comedy and especially a very contemporary feeling comedy to illustrate the history actually allowed the historical figures and the historical actions to seem more resonant and to feel realize how contemporary the politics of the early 19th century are to us.
How contemporary the it's interesting. Let's see if we can hear another tune from the show. This is another American history lesson, emo rock.
Across the Delaware River, Washington acted like a rock star. Washington made America deliver. Washington tried to be a rock star. But all the fame that he had won, it wasn't really any fun. Soon the people started turning. Well, well, well. That boy couldn't tell a lie. Two terms and then he said goodbye. Georgie went back to Mount Vernon. Wow! Why don't you just shoot me in the head? Cause you know I'd be better off. If there's really no place in America for a celebrity in the first rank.
Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Andrew Jackson!
Celebrity of the first rank and a rock star. That's Andrew Jackson.
Exactly.
And you need a rock star to play a rock star.
Yes, and we have one in Benjamin Walker, who has been with us since we first did the show in Los Angeles a few years ago and has been an extraordinary lead in our show throughout thick and thin. And now it's very exciting for us to have him on Broadway in his fabulousness.
The audience needs to care about this character who is, at some points, a very comedic character. Later in the show, we need to care about who he is. That's a tough transition to make because he's playing dumb a fair amount of the time. And then he's got to play, well, something different.
Yeah, I think that we think of the show as a bit of about the adolescence of America and the coming of age of America. And I think watching Andrew Jackson try to bring America into adulthood and bring himself into adulthood is kind of the emotional journey. It ends up, you know, killing his wife and taking its toll on him and on his legacy. And in the end, his legacy as a president is at best a complicated one. And at worst, many people really hate his presidency and what it resulted in.
And you say musical comedy. It doesn't end funny.
No, it doesn't end funny. It ends, I think it ends trying to force the audience, having given them, I think, a lot of laughs along the way, something to really think about, which is, for me, how much responsibility we take for the people we elect and how much responsibility we take for what the people we elect end up doing.
We're talking with Michael Friedman, who is the composer and lyricist for Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, now in previews on Broadway. Let's get a caller on the line, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Mike's with us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Thank you for taking my call. I read a review of this on Indians.com on a Native American news website about a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago. I'm Choctaw and Biloxi. My people fought alongside him, and then he removed us and darn near everyone else so that they could all move in. And the review I saw on Indians.com said a lot of the coarse language, a lot of the stuff that's kind of racist was all left in. Is that without any historical, I mean, is that to kind of keep the historical context of how they were back then, or is that just because it was left in without any research? I mean, that's my question.
I think the certainly the racism that existed in America in the 19th century, and some of which exists with us today, is something we very much wanted to leave intact. Jackson, you know, owned slaves and certainly was incredibly racist towards a lot of Native American tribes. And that's something I think that we wanted to leave very explicit, of making the reasons that Americans were compelled by him and wanted to vote for him, while also showing, I think, a lot of the dark underbelly of what that means.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. You mentioned, of course, Andrew Jackson owned slaves. That is not focused on in this show.
No, we make it clear. It's brought up a few times, and it's something that we had actually looked at ways to bring it in more, and it became something that ended up, I think, burdening the show in a funny way. That it's important that the audience understand that he was a slave owner, and I think he and his wife both think of that as very normal. But I think we wanted to make it clear how normal that was to an early 19th century person. And we now know, obviously, what we know about slavery. For Jackson, that was part of being from the South.
Also, a military officer. Mm-hmm. This is the Battle of New Orleans, where he did beat a professional British army in the field at great odds. Barely gets a mention.
Well, you know, they run in and then he goes and beats the British and we say it was one of the great military victories. So I think we certainly go through it and give it its good mention, and certainly to show what an amazing general he was on the field. But in the end, I think we were more interested in focusing on his presidency itself rather than his legacy as a general.
Well, let's get another caller in. This is Nancy. Nancy with us from Naples, Florida.
Oh, getting myself. In the process of writing a musical,
Nancy, I'm afraid your phone is breaking up. I apologize. We're going to see if you can call back, if you can get a better get some more bars on your phone. Thanks very much. Let's see if we can go instead. We'll go to Luke, and Luke's with us from Churchill. Churchill, where?
Churchill, Tennessee.
Go ahead.
I am Northeast Tennessee. Yeah, I actually had a question. If the composer actually liked Andrew Jackson's presidency, do you think he did a good job? I actually teach high school, and my classroom neighbor, I'm an English teacher, and he's a history teacher, and he says that Andrew Jackson's his first president, and I made the comment and said, yeah, he was pretty good, except, you know, killing all the Native Americans, and he got angry at me because I insulted Andrew Jackson's presidency. So I want to know what kind of job you think he actually did.
I think that we, Alex and I, feel that a lot of his legacy is profoundly problematic for America, both the populist impulse that I think now we're finding is a very complicated thing in our society, and especially with his legacy regarding the Native Americans and slavery as well. That said, I think both Alex and I are more interested in the show of portraying him as honestly and as in the full complexity of who he was and what his presidency was, and allowing the audience to place judgment. I think it's pretty clear for the audience what they can think, and the more and hope that people will actually come to the show and want to learn more and become more knowledgeable about the subject.
The argument is presented in the play that some consider him very problematical. Others say he was the greatest American president of the 19th century.
And I think you'll hear that. If we had enough callers, you'd probably hear both points of view said. He certainly, in my mind, is not the greatest president of the 19th century.
There was a fellow named Lincoln.
Yes, there is a fellow named
Lincoln. We'll hear Lincoln a lot.
There's a few fellows in the 19th century, but certainly, yeah, there's a fellow named Lincoln who I think most people would agree trumps Jackson.
Luke, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate
it. I do appreciate the man and Manifest Destiny comment. I thought that was pretty funny.
I stole it from the show. But anyway, we're talking with Michael Friedman. Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson is the name of the show. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As you make the transition from one theater to another, one audience to another, the number of people involved escalates. You are going from a small operation at the Public Theater to now an entity in and of itself. This is something that has taken on a life and is now staggering out Frankenstein-like on the world.
It's amazing and a little frightening. One of the favorite things that I've ever heard anyone say was Hal Prince.
The great producer.
And director. And I heard him say once, somebody asked him, what are you most proud of? And he actually said, I'm most proud of the fact that Phantom of the Opera, which he directed, has run for so long and has employed so many people that he had created in a show that he had created with the artists involved, a show that actually had become a major economic force in the world. And that, I thought, was sort of an amazing thought of, and it is something you realize when you move to Broadway of how many people are being employed, and what, as you say, it becomes its own living, breathing entity.
And it's not just the company of actors. It's everybody backstage. It's the marketing people. It's the people who sell the merchandise.
Exactly.
Out in the lobby.
The street team, which is something I never even realized
you have
there
a
was.
Street team?
We have a street team. It's exciting.
A street team puts up posters and creates buzz around
the show? They help, you know, they are around 42nd Street and around trying, you know, buzzing up interest and helping sell the show, and they're wonderful. And as you say, yeah, the marketing people, the wonderful people backstage and everywhere. It's really, that's been fun, that feeling like the family of the show grows as we move on.
Mike is on the line. Mike calling us from Iowa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a retired history teacher, taught high school history for 36 years. Most of the textbooks focus an awful lot on the Trail of Tears and Jackson's career as a general, but they give a little bit of short shrift to his economic policy, which brought about one of the worst recessions of the 19th century. I wonder if you'd want to comment on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, his experiences with the National Bank are another. We talk about the National Bank and his sort of fight with it and his ending up shutting it down in the show. In a 90-minute show, there are all these issues that I wish we could treat with, you know, in all the depth they deserve. But that's been an exciting moment, especially over the last 5 years, as I think even now we're dealing with the legacy of his economic reforms. So, yeah.
Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye. And let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Jim, and Jim's with us from Anchorage.
Hello, thanks. I read once that Andrew Jackson claimed, or maybe he was, born in a log cabin, which for the next 60 or 80 years was the standard for all presidential candidates.
And the joke was born in a log cabin he built himself.
Well, that might be the joke, yeah. Is that true? Or?
It's a little – a lot of the claims he made are a little bit questionable, including that one, though it is true. I think what's more interesting is he created some of the ways in which campaigns are made, which is now the idea of I was born in a log cabin is one of those great – you know, claiming your most humble origins and that you made yourself out of nothing is one of the great ways to, you know, run for president.
The previous presidents were all – from privileged, wealthy families.
Yes. Oh, and much is made of that, too.
Yes.
So,
thanks
very much for the call, Jim. And Michael Friedman, good luck with the show.
Thank you so much.
Michael Friedman wrote music and lyrics to Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. He and writer-director Alex Timbers created the show, and he joined us here in the Bureau in New York. Tomorrow, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Paul Rayburn will be here. Next week, we talk to our own Michelle Norris about her new memoir, The Grace of Silence, which reveals the conversation her family never had about race. Join us for that. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in New York.